You're listening to The Law Report, broadcast each week on RN Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. Our website is at abc.net.au/rn/Law Report. And you can find us on Twitter at Law Report RN. Anita Barrow with you. Across Australia, this is Law Week, and in each state, activities are being held to engage the public with the importance and role of the law. In Brisbane, the Queensland Law Society is running tours, which take people on foot or on buses to sites of particular interest, importance or notoriety in the city's criminal and legal history. Radio National's David Bush hopped on the criminal history bus tour for the Law Report. And a warning, there are graphic depictions of crimes in this story.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you on board the Queensland Law Society Criminal History Tour for 2012. The point of these tours is to give you some insights into Brisbane's criminal history and also some of the major legislative events that have happened in our city and that have shaped who we are today.
The Queensland Law Society's Natalie Graff is our host, and our guide is criminal lawyer Glenn Craney.
I'm a lawyer with an interest in history rather than a historian with an interest in law, so that's my get-out-of-jail clause if I need one, if I'm inaccurate in anything today.
The bus hasn't even pulled away from the curb before we're into our first mystery.
In fact, before we kick off, I'll just mention a story even before we go anywhere. And it takes us back to 1938. This bus isn't perfect for the view, but you'll know that Central Station is behind you, and there's the clock tower. This story relates to a lady called Marjorie Norval. Now, Marjorie was the social secretary for the Premier's wife. The Premier then was Forgan Smith. His wife had a social secretary to help organise all sorts of functions, and this was Marjorie Norval. And she was an attractive, active lady and very active on the social scene. In 1938, she indicated that she needed a few days' leave to go and visit some relatives in Bundaberg. She got a friend to drive her to the station, to here, and she was last seen going into the entrance near the clock tower there on Ann Street. A friend dropped her off, saw her walk in. She was never seen of again. We don't know whether there was a crime involved or whether she staged her own disappearance, but it led to one of the biggest manhunts or woman hunts the state had known at that point in time. There was an inquest held into a death, her apparent death. A friend of hers said that he saw her in London some months later, but at that stage he'd been living in London and didn't know she was declared missing. He attempted to say hello to her and he was surprised that she ignored him and just walked on. So whether it was her or not has never been established, and she's never been heard of or seen of since.
And we barely travel 400 metres down Ann Street before we pass the first of many sites related to the 1980s Fitzgerald inquiry into police corruption in Queensland.
On the right, we have the Siebel Citygate Hotel. Those of you who've been in Brisbane for a while will remember it as the Crest and then the Carlton Crest Hotel. It was a hotel that gained some prominence during the Fitzgerald inquiry as one of the various places that Terry Lewis, our police commissioner, would meet with Jack Herbert, the bagman. Being one of the flashiest hotels around in the 70s and 80s, it was not a place heavily frequented by locals. It was more of an interstate businessman's type hotel, so they would meet there in the hope of not being recognised, or at least reducing the prospect of them being recognised.
Heading into South Brisbane, we pass along streets that ran with blood 93 years ago.
We're coming up here to Merivale Street. Along Merivale Street was the scene of what has become known as the Red Flag Riots of 1919. Now, back then, there was a great deal of angst about socialism, communism. The diggers had returned from World War I. The Russian Revolution had occurred in a couple of years earlier, in 1917. And there was a widespread unrest about socialism and its causes, and even trade unionism and those sorts of socialist enterprises. In fact, under the War Precautions Act, as had been enacted during the World War I, red flags had been banned. As a result, there would often be protests from the labour movement and its sympathisers, and they would have everything but red flags. They'd have red banners, red handkerchiefs, red scarves, hence the term red raggers. In 1919, there was a couple of days of particular unrest where, in fact, those associated with the labour cause, including some Russian immigrants, there was a reasonable Russian immigrant population here at the time, and of course that would just fuel concerns about communism and so on. They had their own protest marches. As a consequence, the loyalists, the band of returned soldiers and others who were trying to ensure that socialism and communism didn't get a foothold, had protest marches in response. There was a protest gathering of 7,000 or 8,000, it said, over the other side of the bridge, and then a fair proportion of that crowd broke off across the bridge with a view to levelling the Russian Community Hall. They marched across the Victoria Bridge, where we've just been, down to the Russian Community Hall, which was down in this part of town. And on the night in question, the police got wind of this, attempted to block their progress, and what ultimately resulted was a pretty significant riot. The Russian Community Hall was destroyed. There were significant clashes. Significant injuries were sustained. The mob was carrying guns and bayonets and bricks and bottles and anything else they could find. And in the end, they were blocked by the police in what then turned into a full-scale riot, with the loyalists turning on the police. And the fighting was said to have lasted over 2 hours. There was dozens of police injured, as well as plenty of the rioters themselves.
Our first stop is the scene of one of Australia's most sensational murders.
We're going back to October 1989, probably one of the most graphic crimes in Brisbane's history. It involves four women, Tracy Wigington, Lisa Paczynski, Kim Jarvis and Tracy War, in what became known as the lesbian vampire murder. They picked up an intoxicated Brisbane City Council worker called Edward Baldock over near the Story Bridge, and lured him into their car with all sorts of promises we don't need to go into. And they parked their car just near here, and initially Wigington brought Baldock down here, and behind the boat shed you see directly in front of us. One can guess the sort of promises he was made. He was found completely nude in the end. Paczynski joined Wigington down there. The other two women stayed in the car. The suggestion at trial was that Wigington was someone who was practicing vampire or had vampiric type tendencies. She stabbed Baldock 27 times, almost decapitating him, and then drank his blood. Paczynski stated in court that Wigington had these vampiric tendencies, that she would cut open her wrist and Wigington would drink her blood from her wrist, and that Wigington claimed that she didn't eat solid food but would live on pig's blood and cow's blood, which she would buy from butchers. Wigington pleaded guilty to the charge of murder. That of itself is unusual. In Queensland, murder carries a mandatory life sentence, so there's not a lot to be gained in pleading guilty unless you've got an eye on your parole 20 or more years down the track. Paczynski pleaded not guilty but was found guilty, and she was sentenced to life in prison as well. Kim Jarvis was sentenced to 18 years for manslaughter. That was reduced to 12 on appeal. And Tracy Waugh was ultimately acquitted on the basis that she sat in the car and didn't play any active role. Now, Paczynski and Jarvis were released some years ago. You might recall recent media with Wigington only released in January of this year. So she served about 23 years of her life sentence, which is probably a bit more than most life sentences attract. So that's the scene of one of the most gruesome murders that we have. And those of you who were in Brisbane at the time, indeed in Australia, will recall the significant publicity that it attracted.
We make a stop at Boggo Road Jail. Notorious for its primitive conditions and harsh treatment of prisoners, it was closed in 1992, and now just one of its complexes remains intact.
This is a heritage listed property, and it's the oldest prison remaining in Queensland. So this is, as the prisoners were walking in, this would be their first glimpse of the prison.
Inside the former holding bay for prisoners, Keith Baisley from the Queensland Public Works Department tells the story of the prison and some of its infamous inmates.
First successful escape was in December 1946 from Division 2, led by the prison's most feared escapologist, Arthur Slim Halliday. In the early 1950s, he had been committed for life for the murder of a Southport taxi driver. He was the only prisoner to escape at the time from Division 2. In 1952, after his third successful escape, he made four other unsuccessful attempts to escape, including in December 1953 when he set fire to the prison's mattress shop and attempted to climb through the roof. He was regarded as a top security risk. He served the end of his sentence in number 2 division. His cell was number 9 in D wing, where the most dangerous prisoners were detained. It was equipped with three massive padlocks on specially reinforced door, and his bed was double welded and firmly affixed to the wall.
This story and the accompanying photo of Arthur Halliday were of particular interest to one member of the tour group, Earl Sanders.
Well, when I was 15, I joined the Queensland Police as a cadet and was attached to the photographic section. And you've just showed us a photo of Arthur Halliday. I was here present when they took that photo of Halliday in a little studio we had over there. Waters used to sit in an office here, and we went into the left there somewhere to a little studio. I just came over with the guys from the photo section. Another one used to come over every week, and we got a new cadet. You come over and you take this one, you can take them. And it doesn't take long to learn to take those things.
Back on the bus, and we head into Fortitude Valley, Fitzgerald Inquiry territory, and the site of what was Australia's worst mass murder.
We're coming up to Wickham Terrace here. On the left is one of the more famous establishments. See the massage sign there? That was famous for having Bubbles Bathhouse on the ground floor, which was one of the brothels which became quite prominent during Fitzgerald, frequented, it is said, by police both on and off duty, and by plenty of others. The first floor, the upper floor, was a casino, and in fact in the basement was said to be Jerry Bellino's counting house. Stories talk of people visiting the counting house and the tables being covered in piles of $50 bills as Jerry would count up the nights or the week's takings. So that was Bubbles Bathhouse. Now here on the left, this red and white building here, one of the most important buildings on the tour. We can't stop, unfortunately, but you'll see the Harris Technology. This is the site of the Whiskey A Go Go nightclub. It represents what was then and still is the greatest mass murder in Queensland history. It's a pity we can't stop, but the roads just don't allow us to stop there. March 1973, there were two petrol cans put in the foyer stairwell. The nightclub was on the top floor. There were probably 100 or more people dancing inside there. The petrol drums quickly took a light, and 15 people died. There were people jumping out of those windows. Most of the people who died more of smoke inhalation than they did of burns. That was, at that stage, the largest mass murder in Australian history until the Port Arthur massacre in 1996. The two who were arrested for the firebombing were John Stewart and James Finch. Both loudly protested their innocence, but were convicted of the murders. They took extreme measures to try to get attention for themselves during their trials and when they were in prison. Both of them would swallow wire crosses, which would be held together with rubber bands. The contents of their stomachs would then burn the rubber bands. The wire crosses would spring open and tear their stomach linings, causing them to be hospitalised both during the trial and whilst in jail.
The tour takes in other sites of legal significance. The Regatta Hotel, where women chained themselves to the public bar to change drinking laws. The murder of two psychiatrists in the city's medical precinct of Wickham Terrace. And the violent Springboks tour protests in Spring Hill in 1971, to name just a few. The participants clearly got a lot out of the 2.5-hour excursion.
Oh, it was good. It was interesting. You know, I'd seen it all on the news. It was nice to go around and look at all the spots that you'd seen on the TV and stuff.
Oh, I thought it was really interesting. I am a little bit younger and haven't had first-hand experience with a lot of those things, so it was interesting to see what's going on where you live and things you might not have known about before, so it was good.
I loved it, thank you. It refreshed our memory with all the happenings in Queensland criminal history. It was wonderful.
But the last word goes to our tour guide and criminal law historian, Glenn Craney.
I think above and beyond the obvious interest, just from a historical perspective, the law is a living, breathing thing. It continues to develop, and it develops by building blocks. Each step is incremental, and one really can best understand the current and indeed where we're heading in the future by looking at the past, looking at how things have changed in terms of punishment, in terms of proof, in terms of how trials were run, how criminals were dealt with, how police investigations were conducted, how prisoners were treated. All of those things that give us a better perspective on where we are now and where we're going to be in the future. But it's not all about blood and guts. Often it's about civic protest or social change, and those things are very much at the pointy front end of so much of the things that we talk about on the tour, the way social mores have developed over the years and how people had the courage to stand up and test the law and sometimes suffered for it, but it got us where we are today.
Criminal lawyer Glenn Craney, and that report from Radio National's David Bush. And the Queensland Law Society's Criminal History Tours for Law Week finish on Thursday. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks to producer James Patterson and technical operator Kerry Dell. I'm Anita Barrow. Coming up next is RN Drive with Waleed Ali.